understand supply and demand in a market. If you're buying, don't buy blindly. Go check with the counties, go check with the cities. Is there anything new coming? Does every single competitor have room to expand? Is every single competitor at like 80%? It's an art and a science, but I kind of touched on it earlier in that the biggest enemy of storage is more storage. You know, it's not like we don't have a, I would say generally we have an under, you know, we're undersupplied on housing right now across the United States. In general, we just need more housing.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Zach Quick is a self-storage owner and operator in the Midwest. Zach, his wife, and his two kids reside in Bentonville, Arkansas. Zach, welcome to the show.
Sam, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. Same three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you very quickly tell us in 90 seconds or less, where did you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Sure. Born and raised in Southeast Kansas. I kind of always grew up knowing that I would do something entrepreneurial slash real estate. Not really exactly sure why, just kind of was in me, for lack of a better word. So went and did the corporate thing out of college, did retail, got promoted a few times, but then wife and I kind of started with kind of a garage, buying a house that had a garage apartment, renting that out, got up to about 30 residential units and got stuck, felt stuck. Fast forward to today, we've since sold all those. I mean, we've been in self-storage full-time for about 4 years. So, and I don't miss the residential part. Not that I was in a very different part of it than a lot of people, but yeah. And then now we live in Bentonville, Arkansas.
Man, that's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I think that's a pivot that so many of us have come to at some point. And, you know, I've had plenty of people come on the show who are, you know, have learned and figured out how to scale large single family portfolios. I mean, sometimes thousands of them, but that's something I'm with you. I got stuck. I just went, oh my gosh, like I've hit a ceiling. I don't know how to get beyond it. I'm stuck. And so did the pivot and funded like you did. How did you pick self-storage?
This will sound cliche, but honestly, I was on a family vacation in Nashville, Tennessee. I was sitting in the back seat. My dad was driving. I looked out the door and it felt like God was like tapping on my shoulder and said, look at those bright blue self-storage doors. So just started researching, you know, driven by storage thousands of times and never thought twice about it. And so did research for about a year. And then we were selling a 12 unit apartment that we had originally intended to 1031 into a larger apartment, but decided that was going to be our foray into storage. So we sold the 12 unit apartment and 1031 into our first property. So I would say a good solid year of research, and I was just kind of drawn to it once we started researching it.
There's so much storage out there. How did you find the first one that made sense?
So everything I've ever bought, both residential and self-storage, has been off market. And that's not to say that buying something on market is bad. It's just the way that it's worked for us is that I basically started building out a list in good old-fashioned Excel using county records and just trying to figure out, you know, if I was looking on Google and I saw a property that I thought like, this looks like within the realm of what we could afford. It looks like there's a little bit of upside to it. Then they got a letter from me or they got a phone call from me. And so I did that a couple of times, got close on a couple other properties. And then a guy called me late on a Thursday night, said, hey, come meet me. We went down Saturday morning and shook hands. So it was kind of, you know, kissed a lot of frogs, so to speak. And then that one worked. So
that's fantastic. And so you buy mostly in the Arkansas and Missouri area now?
Yeah, so we've owned all throughout the state of Missouri. Right now, we're pretty much Kansas City and then south to about central Arkansas. So I've owned in Oklahoma City area before. I heavily look in Arkansas, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and we're starting to branch maybe a little bit to, I don't know, Texas, Nebraska, Iowa. But as of right this second, what we own are in Missouri and Arkansas.
Are there challenges to being geographically diverse?
Yes and no, I guess you could say. And some of it, frankly, is just my own comfort level on where we've bought so far. I mean, everything's been within, call it a 4-hour drive. I mean, that's just kind of where I started my direct-to-owner marketing. So recently hired an operations manager to kind of help deal with the day-to-day with our managers and each property. But yes, a fair amount of driving, but I'm kind of fortunate in that where we live, I can touch quite a few metros within, call it a 5-hour drive. And so you can kind of And we're in the Midwest too. So where everyone is trying to buy as opposed to, you know, on the coast. So
that's really, really intriguing. What have you found have been some effective ways to manage these? I mean, are you guys, you have on-site management? Do you guys run like front offices? Do you have, you know, all, is it all remote? Is, I mean, talk yeah. about some tactical things.
Yes. So I've done it all. We've bought and sold a lot over the last couple of years. And really all the ones that we've sold is just with the intent to exchange up into larger ones. So we've done it even from the beginning ones of being me answering the phone calls and the property was 2 hours away. And we just have a guy that was, you know, he was our mower. If there was a maintenance issue, he would check on it. And that can work totally fine, depending on the property and the area. To up to now, you know, across our 7 properties, they're all large enough that they can afford essentially an on-site manager. There's a couple properties that split. So we have some density in the properties themselves that one manager will, she has about 85,000 square feet at one property and another one has 75,000. And then they split about a 40,000 square foot property. So every other week they have the small property, if that makes any sense. So try and get some density geographically obviously helps. But yeah, right now they're all on sites. There's 100 different ways to skin the cat. A lot of people are really passionate about having quote unquote managerless on site or no quote unquote on site manager. I'm of the opinion that if the facility is large enough, they're the delta in what you're saving really isn't there. And especially if it's someone, you know, ideally you have the right person in that seat that's driving business, that's doing a good job. So we're agile, but that's where we're at right now and how we manage the day to day.
Got it. Yeah, that's really intriguing. Talk to us, Zach, about, you know, the size of this, you know, square footage. That's a term that I hear a lot of in self-storage versus, you know, units in multifamily. We always say yeah. we're buying 300 units. We don't really care. I mean, we do care, but not really how many square feet it is. But for you guys, you always mention, hey, it's 80,000 square foot, 40,000 square foot. And you kept saying you keep changing up in size. You 1031, you buy a small one, and that's how you've grown your company, is just keep mm-hmm. buying larger and larger. What's a size that makes sense for you today and why?
Yeah, I would say today, again, if it was right down the road from an existing property, it might be a little bit smaller. But I would say right now, call it 45,000 square feet and up. And mainly because, well, to use this as an example from back in the residential days, like whether I have a house that rents for $1,000 a month or whether I had a house for $500 a month, pretty much costs the same to replace the air conditioner, pretty much costs the same to replace a gutter or a downspout. So really the same thing applies across self-storage. I mean, obviously the more square feet, you know, your maintenance should be a little bit higher just because there's more stuff to fix. But all things aside, your software costs the same. Utilities aren't necessarily double just because it's double the square footage. You know, really labor is kind of your only like sliding scale within that. So yeah, that's generally about the size that I'm looking at. And obviously, again, I'm in the middle of the map. So, you know, the higher rent per square foot, if you were to go elsewhere, like maybe you can go a little bit smaller and it makes sense for you. But I've found that, yeah, I would say that purchase price somewhere between, call it 2.5 million up to 10 million kind of seems to be a little bit of a sweet spot in that there's a little bit less institutional, but it's also a little bit larger than maybe, you know, someone that doesn't know storage, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, talk to us about that. I mean, that 2.5, you know, anything under 5 million, I would say is a typically a tougher commercial asset to get financed. How have you guys bridged that gap? Because I know the bigger the number is, it seems the easier it is to get financing for.
Yeah. Generally, honestly, especially on the purchase side, we're just going with a local regional bank just because they're flexible. If it's more or less in their backyard and they have some experience with you, then they want the loan. They like you. They like the business plan. They understand what you're set out to do. You know, we don't have Fannie Freddie with like multifamily. So generally speaking, like our terms or interest rate is probably going to be a little bit worse, but it's not like it's like, you know, twice as bad or anything like that. So yeah, generally on the purchase side, it's really a small to medium sized regional bank. On the refi, there's a little bit more options in that, you know, if you're willing to do a lower loan to value, you can get, you know, CMBS, life insurance, et cetera. Just no Fannie Freddie.
Right, man. That's very, very interesting. Let's talk about this. You're in a very interesting location in the country there in Bentonville, in that you guys have loads and loads. For those of you that don't know, that's a beautiful part of the country if you've never been. But the reservoirs, there are reservoirs and RV parks and campgrounds galore where you guys are. And then, of course, over into the Ozarks as well. Have you guys dabbled in boat and RV storage in those areas?
Yeah. So actually the very first storage facility that we bought was a boat and RV storage only. Like the smallest unit size was a 12x32, which in normal storage terms, that's huge. So, and that first one was right near Beaver Lake. We were like less than a mile from the boat ramp. So it was an ideal location for that. And then we have had some other properties in the past and some of the other like Ozark lakes in Missouri as well. So yeah, a lot of demand. COVID kind of accelerated the demand. Just a lot of more people who, you know, would normally maybe go on a vacation were like, well, I'm just going to buy an RV. There's a lot less parking for them. Neighborhoods and HOAs do not want them in their neighborhood. They are, you know, we like boat and RV storage. There is no perfect investment by any means, but they can definitely be, you know, you're getting a lower cost per foot. So it's a little harder to develop in terms of making your numbers work as opposed to regular self-storage. People hit your buildings, people back into your doors. Now, granted, usually, you know, you've got cameras and they're on auto pay, so you can make them pay for it, but that doesn't make it any easier, especially when supply chain makes doors, you know, 2 months away from getting them that, you know, there are some. And then from on the flip side too, you know, the biggest enemy of storage is storage. And that's especially true in boat and RV storage. If there's too much supply, it is not very hard to just hook up your boat or your RV and drive down the road and move in somewhere cheaper. You are not going to do that if you just unloaded a U-Haul of 4 bedrooms worth of stuff and, you know, someone's 10 bucks a month cheaper down the road. Like, you're not going to reload the U-Haul and do it. So while boat and RV customers are generally a more, call them price elastic, they're probably willing to pay a little bit more because, you know, they have a boat or RV. That doesn't make them immune. You're somewhat compelled with the market as well, just because, you know, again, it's easier to leave. So of good properties, I think that the demand is definitely there and more so, but yeah.
That's really intriguing. Yeah, those are not things I would have thought necessarily about directly, is just the ability to, you know, up and just move and go somewhere else. And yeah, of course, like you said, also just the damage aspect of it, it becomes a little bit more to manage. And also you got the lower price per square foot, where I would imagine your building costs are going to be just about the same.
Yep. And yeah, I mean, they are essentially the same. And, you know, you're getting higher, larger doors, which could be a cost a little bit more, but there's less of them. So, and your other cost is generally, you know, you could probably build a decent, let's assume it's a single story self-storage facility. You can build a nice size facility on 4 or 5 acres. If you're trying to build a 4 or 5 acre boat and RV facility, it's going to be really cramped and you're just not going to get, just because you need to have that 60, 70 feet in between buildings so that they can move those class A's back and forth and not have the room to back into their units. So need a little bit more land.
Right. Yeah. Your drive aisles are going to be a lot bigger on those facilities. Yeah, it's been interesting just to watch that asset class, especially in the last 12 months. Like you said, I mean, RV deliveries were somewhere, I think 2021 was at 500,000 new deliveries, which is just, I mean, they're going to have a place to put still own in that asset class, or have you sold all those off?
We have one that's kind of a hybrid. It's got a little bit of both. And again, we didn't sell them just because there was anything wrong with them per se. It was more to just scale up into larger assets. But I agree with you. It will be interesting to see how that plays out, because I know of multiple people that, you know, can't buy one right now and they want to buy one just because they're not there. So,
right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. What would be one piece of advice you would give to somebody who wants to invest or begin investing in self-storage?
I would say really, really understand supply and demand in a market. If you're buying, don't buy blindly. Go check with the counties. Go check with the cities. Is there anything new coming? Does every single competitor have room to expand? Is every single competitor at like 80%? It's an art and a science, but I kind of touched on it earlier in that the biggest enemy of storage is more storage. You know, it's not like we don't have I would say generally we have we're undersupplied on housing right now across the United States. In general, we just need more housing. I can't say the same for storage in every single place. So, you know, people don't magically just store more stuff just because it's built. So just really have a good understanding of the supply and demand of where you're either buying or developing.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. Zach, if you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
I would say analysis paralysis is a huge part, especially if you're starting. Is your first deal is not going to make you rich. I mean, if it does, then you're one in a million. So really half of it is just getting in and learning firsthand. You can read all the books. That's only going to help you so much. You just kind of have to get your hands dirty, so to speak. And then it compounds from there. So yeah, get in and do it.
Gosh, love that. Yep, absolutely. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Ooh, I would say one thing I'm really proud of is how we're developing our employees. And then also my wife and I have been really giving back to, there's a children's center here and then a food bank here as well.
That's cool, man. Zach, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. Zach at zachquick.com, Z-A-C-H. I'm one of the few names. So if you just Google me, you'll probably be able to find me. But yeah, reach out anytime.
Awesome. Zach, thank you for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.